Welcome, welcome everybody. As always, today we'll be focused again on tariffs, the impending tariffs, the connotations therein. This panel is sponsored again by Tama ETFs. They manage the American Reshoring ETF, ticker RSHO, among myriad other funds. You can check them out at TamaETFs.com as well as here on Twitter at Tama ETFs. Now, as we will be discussing individual investments, it's important to note that each of your individual circumstances are different, and you need to make sure that you read about each investment carefully so that it fits your risk and return profile. Also note that nothing in this panel should be construed as actionable financial advice or a solicitation to buy or sell any security or derivative. Always conduct your own research or, perhaps better yet, discuss with your licensed financial advisor before making or taking any given investment. Now, I know most of these panelists have been with us before, but as those of us who have come know, I like to keep conversation flowing as fluidly as possible. So while we're going along, feel free to chime in if you have anything to add to one speaker's point. The only request that I have is that we stay muted until the previous speaker completely finishes speaking so we don't have overlap, feedback, etc., because Twitter's audio system causes it to cut out instead of overlap. So we don't want any of that. Now, with all of that said, everybody, let's jump right in with a walkthrough of our panelists. We have with us today, of course, my main man, Yuri Kojamirian, the CIO of today's sponsor, Tama ETFs. He's got over a decade of experience managing UK and global portfolios and co-managed the Magity Fund, where he raised several billion dollars in assets. And in previous panels, I say it every time, Yuri's insight has been extremely helpful to fuel the conversation. Welcome back, Yuri.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, we've got Marco Biegovic again here, the founder and CEO of Arcomino Research, where he provides in-depth research on U.S. macroeconomics and the markets as a whole. He's also got over two decades of experience working in the markets as an equity broker, investment advisor, manager, you name it, Marco's done it. His forecasts and analysis help educate and inform investors the world abroad. Always happy to have you here, Marco. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here again.
Next, we've got modeled behavior. Adam Ozimek is back, the chief economist at Economic Innovation Group, serving on the executive team and leading an ever-growing font of research. He's also served as chief economist at Upwork and senior economist at Moody's, and his research has been cited nearly everywhere, from the Wall Street Journal to the New York Times. Thanks for coming, Adam. Always excited for your thoughts.
Thanks, Nicholas. Always glad to be here.
And next, we've got John Conrad is back, the founder and CEO of prolific maritime and offshore website GCaptain, a go-to source for maritime news, information, networking. They've got it all. John is a font of knowledge in shipbuilding and managed billion-dollar construction projects offshore. Another unique perspective to have with us today. He was great the last time we had him on. It's been too damn long. Welcome back, John.
I'm excited to be here. Thank you.
And thank you for coming. So I'm going to start us right off here with the topic at hand, the impending April 2nd date that's just over the hill here that Trump's administration keeps pointing to for more tariff levies. So to start us off, I want to talk about the concept of the tariffs themselves. Now, Stephen Jen of Urizen SLJ Capital suggests that President Trump's tariff strategies may serve as specifically a negotiation tactic aimed at reducing global tariffs, potentially leading to a stronger global economy. So my question here is, first, could this be an accurate assessment? And second, how effective are such strategies in achieving comprehensive trade agreements historically? Yuri, could you start us off here?
I think it's very important to always sort of take a step back and try to think, what is the ultimate sort of objective of a lot of what this tariff policy is trying to achieve? And one of the most interesting articles I read recently was that the Canadian delegation was down in the White House to sort of understand their position, because obviously one of the interesting things, Canada has been sort of caught up in this, and And we all know that the you know, the replacement for NAFTA is up for review again in 2026. So I think there's an interesting dynamic here to think about how the Canadians are thinking about positioning for that negotiation. But in many ways, what's happening is that it's helpful, I think, for all sides, including the sides that are going to be negotiating, to really understand what is trying to be achieved here. The Trump administration sees the way the world has evolved as unfair. They've seen a hollowing out of U.S. manufacturing. They've seen, interestingly, a big shift away from what they call sort of Main Street to Wall Street. And part of that is this, the financialization of trade. Effectively, as the manufacturing base has been hollowed out, a lot of flows have come into the United States, and this created more financial wealth than it has sort of Main Street wealth. And, you know, say what you will about all of these, the political objective of implementing tariffs is try to rebalance that situation. This is also intricately linked to the position of the dollar as a reserve currency status and trying to understand whether that is a privilege or in some circles, as many of the people advising President Trump believe, a burden. So I think it's useful to sort of start to think about what their position is and what they're trying to achieve. And that will be immensely helpful for anyone trying to negotiate the deals that will come afterwards, because there will be deals. And then what the Canadian article is talking about is, I think, a position where they'll ratchet up the pressure and then they'll start to negotiate with close partners to try to remove some of those. By the way, the advice and some of the original thinking around tariffs doesn't really call for this. This is a more extreme version of that, but this is very classic Trump 1.0 on much higher kind of level of activity and pushing much, much more on the tariff side, which is apply max pressure and then pull back. Of course, what we've had so far has been a lot of uncertainty, and that has been causing a lot of damage to the economy. If you look across confidence, hiring, all of these areas. So many people think perhaps they could try to call Trump's bluff here. But I think if you actually read what they're trying to achieve, the better position for negotiating is to try to understand what the objectives of the other side are and see if there are ways to get to those objectives. And I know sometimes immigration and fentanyl and all of these things are used as a part of the negotiation, and they're part of the broader agenda. I think when it comes to the Europeans, clearly part of the broader agenda is defense spending. So each country has their own kind of elements of what they're trying to achieve. But the main thing that I see in a lot of this analysis is the thrust is to try to rebuild that lost manufacturing base. That is the overwhelming objective. It's across all of the policy papers and all of the thinking that's going behind this. And so therefore, the tariffs will be used for that, to coerce partners, trading partners, et cetera, to rebuild manufacturing in the United States. And I think the sooner the trading partners get that message and understand it, the faster they'll sort of start to believe that there's a way through in this uncertainty.
Thank you, Yuri. A ton to break down there. Brilliant answer. The first thing mentioned that I just want to touch on before I kick this around the panel for more comments is that of the U.S. dollar. So Yuri mentioned that, and some analysts do predict that trade uncertainty kind of centered around these tariffs, the prospect of more tariffs, the prospect of a trade war stemming from the tariffs, could lead to dramatic fluctuations in the U.S. dollar and potentially affecting export competitiveness on behalf of the United States. So Adam, I'd love your take here. Is this a justified concern?
You know, I think the competitiveness argument, this is not the way to go about improving competitiveness of U.S. industries. Even if the goal is to get other countries to change their monetary policy, I think this is not the best way to go about it. I think part of the historical context that's missing here is that we've had in place, you know, international bodies that have helped guide greater integration of trade and reduction of trade barriers over time, and they've actually been very successful. So if you look at the World Trade Organization, and international trade negotiation rounds before that, global tariffs have come down substantially over time. In the early 1900s, tariff rates were much higher, and they've come down a lot. And they've come down through these multinational trading bodies and multinational governance. So that system was working. The idea that we should tear it all up and go back to one-on-one demands, I don't see that as being a very plausible path, because we tried, you know, unilateral negotiations before. Multilateral negotiations have just worked better over time. And it makes sense if there's a big free trading block and you want to be a part of it, and the ticket price is to lower your tariffs, your non-tariff barriers. This is a great way. This is a great way to go about it. So I think that this is not the best path forward to getting more. If we think that other countries' tariff and non-tariff barriers are a problem for the U.S., it's not the path to go about that. The other thing I think you have to consider is that if you wish to enter into a new sort of global monetary regime similar to Bretton Woods, similar to the Plaza Accords, that takes careful diplomacy. And I think that the sort of like incoherent demands, and I'm trying to be fair here, but like when you're asking Canada to become the 51st state, that's not real. We hope it's not real. And that kind of attempt at negotiation is not the way to get other countries to make potentially difficult choices with respect to their own monetary policy and currency depreciation. You need countries to go with you. And these other countries are democracies. And what you're going to see is these broadsides and attacks on allies, these incoherent demands asking for Greenland, asking for Canada becoming 51st state, are actually going to empower parties that are oppositional to Trump, as we've already seen in Canada, with a more progressive party being put into power. We're bargaining with leaders, yes, but those leaders lead democracies, and those democracies respond to the approach that we take with those countries. And I don't think trying to browbeat and just mock and really humiliate our allies is a path to getting what we want, whatever it is.
Thank you, Adam. Does anybody have anything to add to either Yuri or Adam's points here at the top before I jump down another rabbit hole? So I want to touch a little bit on oil and energy here at the top as well. So obviously that's also been a pretty heavy topic, and some are also seeing evidence that we're going to be seeing trade disputes over oil and gas imports in addition to those that kind of already exist, which could lead to higher energy prices. And there's also the question of the amount of energy that Canada provides to the northern and north central United States. How should investors and energy companies kind of prepare for potential supply disruptions, especially given the likelihood that higher costs will be passed down onto consumers? John, I'd love your take on this one, if you don't mind.
You know, Canada is a, this is a difficult conversation for me particularly, because on one hand, there is real strategic concerns with the oil specifically. And, we had the close down and the day one of the Biden administration of the Keystone pipeline. You have transportation concerns with Canadian oil. They have an abundance of it, but how do they get it out into market? They have good ports, but those ports have choke points in the northeast, the St. Lawrence Seaway. And on the West Coast, there's some transportation concerns of getting, materials and raw materials, oil and everything else, out into port. But the broader concern is, what is Canada's relationship to the United States, and how does Canada fit into the domestic policies of Trump? on one hand, you have Trump understand that he's come to the conclusion we need to grow our way out of this deficit. All of the major cabinet secretaries have said that, except RFK, which Trump has specifically said RFK is not touching energy policy here. He's talked about drill, baby, drill, and that lower energy costs are going to allow manufacturing and reduce inflation, reduce costs, and allow us to grow out of this problem. But on the other hand, there are massive security concerns. And you have to put Canada in context of both of these. Can unleashing Canada's natural resources help boost the U.S. economy and lower those energy costs? Absolutely, if we have a closer partnership with them. That may mean bringing them in as the 51st state. I don't think it's total mockery and derision. I think there is an element of truth to the benefit of both parties if we do that. But the bigger concern, and what's missed in all of this economic talk, is military concerns are driving a lot of White House policy. You have Michael Waltz, a former Green Beret colonel at the NSA. We know that the NSA is national security, NSC, is driving a lot of these policies and has a large seat at this table. And the economists who talk about tariffs and so forth don't understand military matters, and the military people don't necessarily understand economic concerns. So there's a steep learning curve happening in the White House as these two bodies merge. We've heard the proof of this is Scott Bessent in, his latest All In podcast interview. He said the biggest surprise of his life is that 40 to 50% of his time as Treasury Secretary is spent on national security concerns. This shows how much of the military aspect is driving these tariff talks. And the economists are not talking about, Wall Street's not talking about these military concerns.
Thank you, John. A ton to unpack there, but the one focus that I wanted to make, just to kind of stay as much on topic as we can in terms of macroeconomics, is that of Canadian sovereignty. So on that note, is that potential backdrop of the economy, I personally don't know if I see a whole lot of economic benefit in the concept of usurping Canadian sovereignty and having assimilation. But I'm going to spin us off back into that topic of reshoring. Trump's consistently argued that tariffs are, in this administration's words, essential for restoring U.S. manufacturing by making it more competitive with foreign industries, thereby, quote, protecting American jobs. The belief is that tariffs on imports will cause domestic companies to be incentivized to produce more goods within the U.S. and create more job opportunities. And indeed, there are a few examples of companies opening new manufacturing in the U.S., such as Hyundai's $5.8 billion Louisiana facility to be. And so I'm curious, are there any examples that show whether initiatives like this are actually driving job growth, or does the potential for lost jobs in an increasingly isolationist policy board pose threat to offset potential job creation? I'd like to hit Yuri with this one and then kick it to Marco.
Yeah, I think it's a very complicated kind of dynamic that has to evolve. And it's important to sort of look back where we've come from. The U.S. has ceded considerable manufacturing share, has lost something like 4 million manufacturing jobs over the last 20 to 30 years. It's almost lost 10 percentage points of global manufacturing share. And I think there's a question whether a lot of this is kind of atrophied, right? And this was is a trend that started to correct a couple of years ago. I think with the passage of the major acts in the U.S., here I'm talking about IRA, the CHIPS Act, the IIJA, they started to put quite a lot of money into the investment of infrastructure, but also to incentivize companies to build. And I call that kind of industrial policy. And so the idea is to sort of subsidize companies to build manufacturing at home. A lot of these companies were already starting to do this because the decision was being driven at the private sector level after the COVID experience, but also in general, the view that supply chains were no longer safe the way the world was evolving. You know, because of wars, trade wars, supply chain insecurity, port strikes, all of these things. And so the companies we were speaking to were starting to say, well, actually, the incremental capacity I'm probably going to put in the US. And then the US gave them a big kick, you know, in terms of pushing that along by introducing some of these generous subsidies. And the focus of a lot of these subsidies was on what we call critical industries. And I think that's an important thing that we can maybe debate in this panel. One of the interesting things that we find is that the one of the sort of few arguments that you can make for tariffs directly impacting and helping reshoring an industry is by providing kind of protection for some domestic industries that are in their early stages of development. Actually, if you look back at the history of the United States early on, tariffs were used very, very widely to build all those nascent industries against kind of the European competition that was happening at the time. And there are actually lots of examples of natural experiments as well, where tariffs were used to build industries that didn't exist or maybe had atrophied. And if you think about what those are in the modern age, they're probably things like semiconductors, electric batteries, you know, future technologies and transition, energy, nuclear, all of this kind of stuff. And to make those industries appear again, tariffs can directly help protect that. And this is an economist term, it's called the infant industry argument. Some people argue, and I think there's some debate back and forth, that the import quotas that were introduced in the 1980s in against Japanese cars were actually instrumental in rebuilding the US car manufacturing industry, which at the time had been decimated by Japanese competition. The flip side, of course, of that is consumers paid for that. The prices of cars went up and the quality probably went down at first. And I think it has readjusted over time, but it did give a huge boost to that industry over time. And so I think you can kind of argue tariffs probably provide that sort of protection. But the reality is tariffs, the way they're being implemented by this administration, are also basically kind of a way of threatening companies and saying you need to accelerate some of these investment plans that many of them had. And we've already got a government website. And there was one under the Biden administration, and there's now one under Trump, where they started to collect the announcements made by companies. Now, I've been in the investing game for almost 20 years. I've seen many announcements by companies where they sort of bundle together every possible number they can to come up with an even bigger number to make it look like it is. But there's always a kernel of some of this truth. And this goes across a bunch of different sectors, you know, whether it's Apple's announcement about massive announcement making investments in the US in terms of data centers, but also manufacturing capacity, or Eli Lilly, who already had plans to build out in places like Indiana, but are accelerating some of those plans and adding an incremental, they say, $25-27 billion. So I think there's kind of the infant industry argument, you could say, that they will provide protection for some of these critical industries, then the sort of accelerating investment by some of these companies. And then there's the kind of question of what is the carrot that's going to come at some point as well, because as we speak, the conversation is focused on tariffs, but at some point, there'll be a conversation focused on tax cuts and helping kind of reinvigorate industry. And some people argue that the market maybe short-term is going to get hit on a lot of this kind of tariff uncertainty, but in the back end, you have potential extension of some of these tax cuts, which could also continue to help benefit manufacturers in the United States. So I think there's three ways it could work. I think you have to also remember that the acts that were passed in 2020 continue. So you still have that kind of powerful industrial policy. It may change. They may get repealed and they may change in their nature. But essentially what's happening is there is a kind of this forces, all these forces are pushing more and more companies to reshore to the United States, and they're kind of coalescing right now. And the tariffs are part of the picture, but not the whole picture. But the jury's still out. I think these things are very complicated to make a genuinely competitive industry globally. From scratch is something that takes years and is difficult to implement. And so there will be some industries where it doesn't work, some industries where it might work. We've already actually seen some early examples of US success, for example, in the production of solar panels, where the US has, I think, quadruple or quintuple production of panels and that are globally competitive. And that is really thanks to IRA and the protection that the subsidies that's provided, but also the tariffs, because unlike people forget, the Biden administration continued a lot of the tariffs implemented under Trump and then implemented some more specifically protecting certain industries. And so I think there's an argument to me that if you can do that in solar panels, you could probably do it in batteries, you could do it in semiconductors at the leading edge. And so you could think about some of these critical industries, and those are the futures of a lot of industries. And so you could make an argument that reshoring is really, really strengthening, but it's a long-term game. It's a long trend, and it probably needs that extra benefit. We need uncertainty to go away and some of the positives of policy to come in.
Thank you, Yuri. I'm going to come back to some of those reshoring initiatives that you guys are tracking. But first, I want to touch on what you said about automobiles a little bit. So the times that we've seen inflated tariffs on things like steel, for example, the automotive industry obviously has suffered from that in the past. And just this week, I think it was Monday, Trump announced that he intends to announce additional tariffs on automobiles specifically, as well as lumber and chips. And so I'm curious, Marco, will this cause another situation where we see higher vehicle prices for consumers, higher costs to manufacture for American manufacturing companies?
Yeah, definitely. It should. These tariffs should translate into higher auto prices. I wanna say something else regarding auto manufacturers, and this is when these tariffs are introduced, let's say April the 2nd. Actually, all of these auto manufacturers will be faced with a decision whether to transfer their capacities back to the US or not to, because if they choose to actually transfer these facilities back to the US, it could mean that it actually takes them something like 3 or 4 years to build a plant factory for producing cars. And this is like, okay, in 3 or 4 years, we don't know what is actually going to happen. Like, well, Trump will not be president anymore, of course, but maybe, I don't know, will a Republican be president then? Will a Democrat be president then? I mean, it's there's a lot of uncertainty, and they actually need to make this decision. And I can relate and actually they probably don't know what's the best decision to make at this point, because it will take them years to build something for which they actually don't know whether they will need it in 4 years or not. And this is something that is making all this more difficult. If they decide to invest, actually, probably we will see construction jobs going up. But these manufacturing jobs actually won't go up much until they actually build all of these facilities, and it could take years for that to realize. So this is kind of like people think, okay, Trump is going to introduce tariffs and the things are going to change immediately, but actually it's more about the lag, and we actually need a lot of time before we start seeing the effects of that. In the meantime, the prices will surely go up, because people will still want to buy these vehicles, and if these vehicles are produced in Canada or Mexico, they will cost more. There are numerous estimates for how much a price of an average vehicle could go up, probably something like $3,000 to $5,000 per vehicle, depending on what the actual tariff will be in the end, because we still don't know what tariffs will be implemented on April the 2nd, because a lot has been said so far, and there were some conflicting statements. So we just need to wait to see what is actually going to be implemented, and then after that we'll probably get a better sense of what kind of an impact could these tariffs actually have.
Yuri earlier mentioned the IRA, but I want to just kind of tickle the topic a little bit of the CHIPS Act, something that the current administration has been pushing to repeal. And this wanting to repeal it is something that the former director of the CHIPS program office at the U.S. Department of Commerce, Mike Schmidt, has called, quote, a national security risk, citing concerns of U.S. energy independence. Now, with tariffs also targeting energy imports, and with, you know, Canada's floated the idea of heavily tariffing the energy exports to the United States, and in some instances have even entertained the idea of shutting it off, so to speak. Should the Republicans in the House and Senate repeal the CHIPS Act, what issue may arise in the U.S. energy infrastructure programs currently underway, especially in the semiconductor space as well, trying to pull back reliance from Taiwan superconductors, for example? Adam?
That's a great question. I don't think that the Trump administration is going to repeal the CHIPS Act. I think, you know, that's something he certainly said, but, you know, he says a lot of things. I think that it is a piece of legislation that is aligned with their priorities. And really, there's only one reason why Republicans have sort of polarized against the CHIPS Act, and that's the kind of mandates that came along with it. You know, it was a bipartisan legislation. It had bipartisan support. It's obviously important, I think, for national security and, you know, U.S. technological innovation. And it just goes to show that, you know, you have to be careful about taking bipartisan industrial policy and sort of larding it up with all these mandates and requirements. And to be frank, this is the bipartisan issue at times where it's, you know, the requirements are bad in when they polarize, right? So one party fills it with a bunch of, like, you know, union mandates and whatnot, and the other side polarizes against that. But they're also bad in the sense that they raise costs for producers, and they undermine the goals of the industrial policy itself. And that kind of issue is bipartisan in the sense that you're constantly seeing Buy American mandate strengthened. These are things that raise the cost of our infrastructure, raise the cost of our industrial policy, undermine the key goals. So I think what would be great would be if we could get more bipartisan support around support for this, smart support for the semiconductor industry that really is sort of ruthlessly focused on cost reduction. You know, we gave chip makers a lot of money, and they took that money and they built fabs here. That's happened. But what hasn't happened is we haven't made even the tiniest dent in closing the cost gap, which is estimated between 30 to 40% of producing semiconductors in the U.S. and other countries. You know, one of the other commentators suggested tariffs could do this. This is a disastrous idea. I mean, we have you. It's not just about producing leading semiconductors, but also the industries that use leading semiconductors. You're going to make them completely uncompetitive if you don't allow them to import semiconductors from wherever whoever's producing them at the leading edge, whoever's producing the best of them. It's not just about semiconductors. We also want to be making, you know, drones, and you know, these chips are important for the defense industry broadly. And the idea that we should be raising costs on what should be other globally competitive industries is just completely backwards. You know, we have to win these battles by having the best industries. That's it. That's full stop. We have to have the best companies in these industries if we want to win these battles. And you don't get that by tariffs. It's just not how it works. I think it was Yuri who spoke about the, you know, how the United States industrialized in the first place. With all due respect, that history is just completely wrong. It's not the case that tariffs are what drove U.S. industrialization in the 19th century. In fact, if you look at which industries were protected by tariffs and which ones weren't, it's the industries that weren't protected by tariffs, which includes utilities and services, that had the highest productivity growth. Tariffs undermined industrialization by reducing capital deepening. You know, you can't import the newest machines from abroad. Well, then you're not globally competitive. Then you're having slower productivity growth. So, you know, the economic history here, I think, is not in favor of the idea that tariffs are a reliable way to improve industries. I would say what you should look at is the steel industry. U.S. steel, not just the company, but the industry, is not globally competitive. You know, steel users in the United States pay a huge premium because we don't have a competitive industry. Instead, what we have is an industry that has been babied and protected for a century. You know, there's a long history of protectionism for U.S. steel industries, and it has not gotten us globally competitive firms. There simply is no substitute for competition when it comes to getting globally competitive firms for staying at the leading edge. You can't stay at the leading edge by babying and protecting your companies, right? Especially when these companies are like 100 years old. I mean, give me a break, over 100 years old. It's like, it's too late. So I think we need to focus on how do we make these companies stronger? How do we make these companies more competitive, turn them into exporters? How do we lower our costs? And, you know, deregulation and high-skilled immigration are far, far, far more reliable, consequential, and important for leading-edge advanced industries than tariffs would be. And they don't come with the disadvantage of causing a lack of competition and making industries less productive over time, and also harming downstream industries.
Thank you, Adam. So one thing I want to touch on there is this concept of protective tariffs. So actually, if you look at Canada, for example, and this is something the Trump administration cites as, you know, justification for current newer tariffs being levied against Canada, which we'll get to as well, that commentary. But their tariffs on dairy, which can reach up to, I think, 245-250% in some cases, and like I said, is justification for some tariff suggestions by the Trump administration. However, experts do argue there's missing context there, that this specific Canadian tariff is designed to protect Canadian producers from international competition, lest they be at risk of being driven out entirely by foreign corporations. And we've actually seen that plenty domestically. I'm from a rural community, pretty in tune with kind of some of that. We have seen plenty of examples of corporations just kind of destroying the concept of mom and pop farms. And Canada tariffs on dairy specifically work to protect from that. And so there might be a little bit more context there, a little bit more than meets the eye. And so, Yuri, first, if you have anything to respond to what Adam was saying, please do. And in addition to that, how do you feel about that notion that Canada's protective tariffs to protect their farms, which has been mostly successful with a little asterisk on the side of it, and you know, whether or not there's just more context to that?
So I think, first taking some of Adam's arguments, I think, look, the point I was trying to make is not that this is the only solution and the only way forward, and neither is it like the only thing that can be responsible. What I can see happening in the United States is the following. If the CHIPS Act continues, and I think you're absolutely right, it is a bipartisan piece of legislation. I think one of the most bipartisan pieces of legislation passed in recent history. And much of the dollars that the CHIP Act is allocated are going to Republican states, including Michigan, including Arizona. And in many ways, this is this does have support from both sides. That these, just so everyone's aware, that the sums involved are large, but they're not actually that large in the context of the capital expenditure required by semiconductor manufacturing. It's a highly, highly capital intensive process. But by virtue of spending money, especially if it's subsidized money. And as you know, it's partly these are tax credits on capital spent in the United States. Part of it is subsidies as well. And for a long time, the government had allocated the funds, but didn't actually distribute it to the companies. So the companies were complaining, saying, you know, you've told us we've been awarded the subsidy, but it wasn't showing up in their cash flow statements. So what I'm trying to say here is that semiconductor is a highly capital intensive industry. It actually needs capital as the most important element to invest. And once you have that, you can actually build fabs in the United States that can be globally competitive. The analysis that the CHIPS Act organization, of course, they're going to probably be biased, is that they think that in the next 5 to 10 years, the United States will be home to producing 30% of the world's leading edge semiconductors. And these are the ones that are going into GPUs, going into mobile phones, like the ones at the smallest possible resolution in terms of nanometers. Even and pressure is being applied to TSMC, the world leader in this manufacturing, to invest in the United States. And there's even conversations now that TSMC might start to help out Intel, which is, I think, a very interesting dynamic as well. So this is much more than just tariffs, right? This is an idea that, look, this industry is extremely important, as Adam said, to lots of other parts of the United States. We're talking about energy security, we're talking about defense security, we're talking about everything, right? And in fact, if you believe in artificial intelligence in a way that is going to revolutionize the world, it's vital for that. And so, but what it really needs is capital and expertise that needs to come through. And I think that's being pushed through in the United States. And it's a great example of, the jury's still out, whether you can combine an industrial policy like the CHIPS Act with some form of protectionism. And where I disagree with Adam is that it's not that I'm saying the tariffs were responsible for the entire industrialization of the United States. I agree with you that it's very, very important that tariffs are lifted to open up companies to global competition, because that is the ultimate driver of productivity for sure. You know, I was educated as an economist. I know the powers of the free market that can have impact on this. But I also know that in certain cases, you might want to use some sort of protection early on in to allow industries to establish themselves. And I think what the Trump administration is trying to do is put extra pressure on companies like TSMC, like international companies, to invest in the US, to build the fabs there so that the capacity is there. And it's a real push. If you ask me, I think where they're maybe going wrong is a company like Intel is clearly not doing well and teetering on the edge, has not been able to invest to keep up in the leading edge and used to be the leader in manufacturing. And this was my point. We have industries in the US that have atrophied over time that need to be reinvigorated. And something like the CHIPS Act combined with some sort of protections is actually a great combination of policies to put that in place. Is it going to work for sure? Absolutely no idea. It's a globally competitive industry. It's important that it's done well and done right and targeted. And I think that is the fundamental problem. It's not that these things are going to solve the problem. They're going to help some of these industries. And then to go to the point on Canada and farms, I think when it comes to agriculture, I think it's a very political sector in many ways. It's large volumes. It involves voters in rural parts of both Canada and the United States. It's powerful lobbies. There's a lot of interest going into that. And I think some of the motivation on tariffs on both sides, on all sides around the world in agriculture, can often be related to political objectives and geopolitical objectives. So I don't think there's necessarily an economic element to that as much as it's protection of local industries. And there, I would agree with Adam that in many ways, it probably isn't productive as it hasn't been in the steel industry, as it hasn't been in many other industries. I guess my fundamental point is that I think I can already see some examples of successful reshoring in the United States, even in the short history of where these policies have been put in place. And this trend is, for the first time that I've seen it in my career, certainly really establishing and taking hold. And so we'll have to see. But the thing that always makes me more comfortable about all of the reshoring stuff is companies are actually making this decision. So yes, chips production is still not economic as it is to manufacture in Taiwan. Yes, the manufacturing processes are more leading edge there, but it's important that you spend the money and you catch up. Otherwise, you'll fall further and further and further behind, especially if a company like Intel falls apart. I guess my point is that if companies are making that decision themselves, so maybe moving away from some of these industries that are part of policy, many of the industries that, and companies we talk to are making these investments in the US because they see that there's a supply chain risk, or there's they're worried about some of the actual wars or having to ship goods. And the recent experience has suggested that it's just safer to have supply chains there. And if you layer on top of that automation and some of these developments, and maybe some of these critical industries will help foster, you can kind of see a private sector case for reshoring. And that's something we haven't seen in a long time.
Thank you, Yuri. And you gave me a perfect tie-in to something I'm glad to have John here for, is back on that topic of supply chains. The recent travel advisories numerous companies have placed on travel to and from the US, such as Canada and the UK, kind of has a lot of people worried about shipping, because historically, travel advisories can indirectly affect shipping by influencing the movement of people and potentially disrupting those supply chains therein. Although they're not directly designed to affect shipping operations, we do have historical precedent to show that they very much do. Now, I want to avoid the politics of the matter as much as possible. So the rationale of those travel advisories notwithstanding, John, can you break that down for us? What might we observe with supply chains, with shipping, amidst a world of travel advisories against the U.S.?
The amount of, you know, global media interest and pushback on this tariffs. I've been covering the maritime industry since launching GCaptain 18 years ago, and I have never seen this amount of hyperbolic response to any policy in the world. Just they are taking out, you know, particularly the Europeans, but also some in Asia and around the world. They are using every available tool in the kit to fight back against these trade tariffs, and not just the tariffs, but right now we have a week-long hearings at USTR about this proposed $1 million port fee for any Chinese ship that comes into the United States ports. The amount of pushback, public hearings, comments, trade associations around the world, economists, economic think tanks, it is just an enormous pushback. And not just the media, they are using diplomatic pressures and like travel advisories, military pressures, anything in their toolkits to push back on this. And I think if there's one thing that I can highlight in all my conversations with all these people I highlight, and I was at the White House a week and a half ago talking about tariffs and trade. It wasn't a high-level discussion. It was a relatively junior. But what I received from them, and the one piece that really resonated me and stuck in my head, is that we had a very linear, very simple economic policy, you know, since World War II, specifically since the Cold War. And if you kept your head down and put more money into bigger ships, bigger ports, more trust in the economic system, less concerns about military, and, you know, we had a little bit of a piracy off Somalia, but if you focused on doing what you did best, moving goods from one country to another, and just put as much money and talent into that simple process, you came out ahead. And what that did is it selected for linear thinkers. And I think it's there's been a wave of it even in our education system. You know, you get the best grades, you study for the SAT, you follow these rules, you can go to the best schools and emerge as a trade economist at a best think tank. Well, there's a realization now that the world is fracturing. Whether you blame China or Russia or the Houthis and Iran, the world is a more dangerous place. We are fighting amongst each other. There's more political fighting. There's more geopolitical stress. There's more actual kinetic. I mean, we are having ballistic missiles hitting commercial ships and rerouting a huge amount of ships around Africa. So that linear system that all these people who have reached top positions have come through and known, and we've selected for linear thinkers, that is gone. Whether you believe in tariffs or you don't believe in tariffs, or you think there are better ways, that simple world that is peaceful and the oceans can move more goods, that is gone. The question is, how are we going to manage this complexity? And the thing about managing chaos and complexity is there is a cornucopia of ways to do it. There are military trade solutions, diplomatic solutions, tariffs, industrial policy, and there's no perfect solution, right? What you need to be able to do is you need to be able to move fast, and you have to be able to correct for mistakes. And I think that's really the core realization of the Trump administration, the White House, is realizing we would all love to go back to a free trade world where everything is simple, but that is not possible. But the point is, we are the just throw more government resources, bigger governments, more things at the same linear solutions is not working. We're moving into a complex and chaotic world.
Thank you, John. So I want to touch again here on the perception of the international community, specifically being not necessarily just the travel advisories, not necessarily just the tariffs, but the whole situation they're in. The markets in general tend to not like ambiguity. We see, you know, almost endless times at this point, I imagine, for those that have been around for a while and paying attention, that we'll often see, you know, rallies on bad news in the markets, because it gives, I don't want to say a concrete answer, but it ties up some of that ambiguity. They now have a better idea of what's going to happen. So sometimes we'll see positive movement on awful news, depending on the scenario. And so I'm curious, is this whole situation at all scaring off international investors? Are there any signs of nervousness from the international finance theater with investing in the United States right now? Let's go Marco Adam.
Things are not really looking good from this side of the pond. Actually, people are quite nervous. I mean, they're probably more like jittery, because nobody knows what is going to happen next. Like one day we hear about tariffs, and the other day we hear about some other tariffs, or we hear about these tariffs being less impactful than previously thought. So it's more like this uncertainty is actually troubling people when making investment decisions, like what's best to do now when actually there is this higher uncertainty. Like, uncertainty is always present in the markets. That's how you actually make money in the market. But with this kind of uncertainty, investors are mostly not familiar with. Like, they just depend on what the headlines will be around tariffs, what we will hear next, and it's like nobody knows exactly how to position themselves to weather these let's say uncertain times. So it's more like, okay, if I'm uncertain what is going to happen, it's probably better for me not to do much. Like, let me sit and wait and just assess the things. This is kind of like what the Fed has been doing. They are in a wait and see mode, and investors are kind of like in a wait and see mode. There are actually numerous theories what might happen on April the 2nd, next week. But it all depends on how broad all of these tariffs are going to be. And not only how broad in terms of goods that will be tariffed, but also in terms of countries, whether there will be some exemptions and so on. And this is like we still don't know what is going to happen. For example, it could be that the administration just comes and they say that, I don't know, they decided to extend this the deadline for introducing tariffs for another month, for example. Or they just say, okay, we are going to just introduce some tariffs on April the 2nd, and then we're going to introduce some other tariffs on, I don't know, May the 1st or whenever. And it's like this kind of uncertainty, I think it's the most troubling thing at this moment. Like, people are probably not worried that much about tariffs itself as to what like they are actually worried about the uncertainty. They don't really actually know what are the rules of the game. So they usually say, okay, tell me the rules of the game and I'll know how to play. But at this point, I don't know the rules of the game, and this is like more frustrating.
Thank you, Marco. Adam, I'd love your thoughts there too on the international theater perception of kind of what's going on from the investor's point of view.
You know, there's no aggregate data to measure here. I would talk about, you know, in terms of that specific question, investor perceptions in the U.S. I would say a couple of things to think about, though. One is that the U.S. does have a policy lever here to, at least on the margin, improve this, which would be to approve U.S. deals purchased by Nippon Steel. I know the Trump administration is working on this, but like, boy, nothing discourages FDI like saying we can't trust one of our closest allies to own U.S. steel. It's not a real national security concern. And this brings up a good point, because I've heard a few times today, well, there's national security issues and there's economic issues, and these are sort of separate, and the economists don't understand national security issues. And there's certainly some truth to that. I wouldn't know exactly which semiconductors are most crucial to national security. That's legitimate. But I do think that there is an important economic insight for national security questions, which is that it is often an excuse. It is often an excuse for something that is being done for other reasons. U.S. Steel being a great example. We now know that Biden's national security advisors roundly supported the purchase, and it was an entirely political decision based on not wanting to make the steel unions mad. So just because something is a national security excuse doesn't mean it's necessarily a national, it's like circled as a national security issue that economists can say nothing about because they don't have the expertise. I think the opposite is often true. Relatedly, when we're talking about FDI, I think you have to look at some of these one-off examples with a little bit of scrutiny. So what happens with tariffs is that the executive has incredible discretion in choosing who gets exempted from tariffs. And they just decide, well, this company gets an exemption, that company gets an exemption. This is a highly politicized process. And so what you'll see is companies saying, because of the administration's tariff policies, we're deciding to do this, make this huge investment in America. It's such a great, we're so glad that the administration did this. It's really important. And we really support everything they're doing. We did this because of you. And then what you find out is actually that investment was planned a decade ago. Apple Computer had a really great example of this, where they, in the previous Trump administration, where they went down to tour the factory, and Trump said, they built this factory because of me. And it just shows that, my policies are working. And then the reality is that factory had been built in like 2013 or something like that. So just completely taking credit for something that had already been done. But then why did Apple just sit there and nod? And the reason they sat there and nod was because they were seeking tariff exemptions for the Apple Watch and for parts of the Mac Pro. So you can't take company statements at face value here, because these companies are seeking to get exemptions from the administration. So when you find a foreign company, to bring it back to the topic at hand, when you find a foreign company saying, I am investing in the United States, thank goodness for these tariffs that the administration put in, we wouldn't be doing this otherwise, you have to bring a little scrutiny to that, because they are probably also seeking favor from the administration. And finally, in terms of, is this a great investment environment in the United States? I would say the stock market is providing one indicator that, at least on the margin, tariffs are not making the U.S. a better investment environment, right? It's pushing the stock market down. The stock market's not happy about it. U.S. firms are not happy about it. I don't want to be too negative about the United States. It's still, you know, the biggest rich economy in the world, still a great place to invest. So, but I don't think that the protectionism is on the margin something that's helping. It's something that's hurting.
Good points, Adam. I always love having a nice, good bit of backdrop from all sides of conversations. It just makes things a lot easier to break down, a lot easier to get good explanations from our panelists. So I want to wrap us up on kind of a positive note in terms of reshoring. I know that Tama's RSHO is up, I think, like 41% on the since inception scale, and it does seem to hold pretty strong when compared to other similar ETFs in the space. And so I'm curious, Yuri, amidst all of this ambiguity in the markets, the uncertainty, how are folks at Tama managing these reshoring initiatives that we are seeing examples of, even from foreign companies? What's kind of going on at RSHO? What are you guys watching? And what are some of those examples of reshoring success for some of these companies that you guys invest in?
So I guess we spend a lot of time on the ground, kind of going and trying to see some of these investments that are being put into the ground. And I definitely agree with Adam that, companies, they'll say what they have to get the right messaging to the agenda, to the administration. The public messaging of all of these investment announcements is carefully thought through. The numbers are probably much bigger than they are. But I just go back to this fundamental thing where when we talk to companies that are not necessarily trying to win tariff, what's called relief, they are telling us that they're making a lot of these investments because they're trying to protect their supply chains. And most of the companies, there was a big switch, I would say, about 5 years ago. Part of it was COVID, but really also what came after in terms of some of this trade uncertainty, but also wars, et cetera, that just switched the calculus in the boardroom to one of making these investments in the United States. And I think that's what you're seeing in the long-term trend of the companies that we invest in. Manufacturing construction is up a lot. Companies are investing in the United States. I think it's true that the uncertainty since the start of the year, especially in the way these tariffs are being talked about, has put a dampener on business optimism to invest in the US. I think that is destabilizing, and markets hate uncertainty. And the companies that we talk to are saying that we continue to see some of this investment, but everyone's a bit worried. They're not sure. And when people aren't sure, they do pause activity a little bit. What we're trying to do to protect investors in the fund and to kind of think about that is we focus a lot on companies that are just up the higher quality scale, businesses that have just been around for a long time that are benefiting from shoring in terms of more activity in the United States, but over the medium to long term. And they're not sort of greenwashing themselves or like talking about reshoring as a new trend suddenly, but they're just businesses that have been doing business for a long time. They're high quality businesses. They dealt with tariffs under the Trump administration. They're prepared for the tariffs this time around. All of the companies are telling us that they have the muscle memory and the systems and tools they need to adjust to this environment. And that's the type of businesses that we invest in, ones that have been through cycles, that have seen uncertainty, are resilient and actually kind of take advantage of uncertainty and invest more and try to get ahead of their competitors, whether they're at home or abroad. And so what we do is we just have higher quality businesses. And that's what we think through the cycle. This is an interesting trend because medium to long term, I think the reshoring trend is here to stay because it's being driven by the private sector. And it's just been kind of accelerated by some of these policies. Medium term, I think the picture will be a lot clearer in a year or two's time when maybe some more business-friendly policies that were talked about during the election kind of come through. Right now, we just have the rhetoric around tariffs, and that creates a lot of uncertainty. And so you've got to use that as a bit of an opportunity and be in high quality businesses, because they're the ones that are going to kind of live through this period. And that's what we're trying to do with the RSHO funds. I think the market is also was very excited about the Trump administration being positive for business, and sort of got ahead of itself. And this uncertainty right now is creating turbulence, but turbulence often leads to opportunities down the line. And that's what we're seeing on the ground. And I just want to say to everyone listening that in many ways, a lot of this manufacturing sector is actually happening. I mean, the portfolio manager for our social fund was just on the road last week to places like Ohio, to Arizona, and you can see it happening, the construction on the ground. When you talk to people, equipment companies, testing, safety, et cetera, all of that is investment is going in. Is there going to be a pause? Probably. That's possible when there's uncertainty. But I think over the medium term, this sort of environment is perfect, where you have a clear policy agenda at the government level and a driver from the private sector to reshore and rebuild the United States manufacturing base.
John, one last comment there.
Yeah, I mean, what the market really wants is consistency. And from what I've heard about these big deals that Trump is making about, you know, bringing like CMA, CGM, bringing ships and deal with Saudi Arabia and some Japanese companies to reinvest in America, what I hear consistently in the background from a lot of these companies is that the White House says, we don't know where we're going with tariffs. We don't know what the security situation is. We don't know what the future of China is. We don't know if Canada will be a 51st state. They're putting out all these ideas. But what they are saying to everyone and reassuring them is, we know that the United States has reserve currency, that we have the safe borders, that we have the best military, that we have the best transportation networks existing. So this is a safe place to reshore. That message has been consistent. Whether you believe it or not, that's another question. But everyone I talk to in Washington says Trump really believes in this reshoring and welcoming companies in.
Thank you, John. So Yuri, on RSHO and all of the comments we've had from every panelist today, it seems like we're in a bit of a head on a swivel situation, paying attention to, you know, which companies giving off good, strong examples of their reshoring and how they're positioning themselves amidst this uncertainty. Where can people find more about RSHO, about Tama? And maybe point to some of those resources, the publications that you guys do on site as well, to close us out here.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, we spend a lot of time talking to the companies on the ground, looking at some of these things at the kind of micro level. And I think that's important because as many of the panelists have said, the macro level is actually very difficult to call. Economies are very dynamic things, productivity, different sectors, how they interact with each other, how many goods are brought into the United States. All of these things make a big difference to how the economy evolves. But at the micro level, a lot of this reshoring trend has got established a couple of years ago and really has continued on the ground. And for those interested in learning more about it and kind of learning more about the fund and the way we invest, they should head over to our site, www.tamaetfs.com. There you can read a lot of the articles we write. We've just recently written a piece about tariffs and reshoring. There's actually one coming out very soon that focuses on kind of made in America as a concept, because a lot of the policies of the Trump administration use that as their key concept. It's a concept that's been sort of in and out of favor for a long time, but we think it's potentially something that is going to be very interesting as a way of framing some of these investments and to understand that. And I think an important part of that is also, how are we going to solve the energy part of this? Because a lot of being able to build some of these factories is the electricity and energy that's required for them. And that, I think, is an important element of showing and an important part of it as well. So that's what that latest piece addresses. But there's loads on our website in terms of kind of looking at bits of analysis, understanding the difference between reshoring and nearshoring, understanding the impact of the election, some of the Trump administration stuff, but also really seeing what's going on the ground at the state level. And as you read through those articles, there's lots of sources that we see, especially from the White House, but the Commerce Department, trying to get unbiased data about what's going on in the United States and how they affect these policies are coming through. So yeah, head on over to www.temaetfs.com, and there under the insights page, you can get a lot of information, and then do subscribe because you can receive the latest pieces as they come out.
Definitely do that, folks. I've been reading pretty much every time we have a TAMA panel, I hop on there and see what the new articles are. It's broken down in a way that I can understand it. So if I can, as I promise, you can too. That'll wrap us up today, everybody, on the Trump and tariffs. Big thanks again to Adam, John, and Marco, and of course, Yuri, for lending us their expertise and insight today. Stay on the lookout for any upcoming Unusual Whales panels. We'll be here at the same place. Thanks for coming, everybody. Have a great rest of your day.